Yes, you do endeavor to maintain the alert and receptive mind of Zazen. So tonight, I'm going to give a Dharma talk, which I think might be called Practicing with One's Craziness. It's going to be a little story about how I do that. And I am going to draw heavily on this book, Saying Yes to Life, Even the Hard Parts, which I worked on with Ezra Beda. Ezra Beda is a Dharma heir, a Zen teacher and Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Ben. And they're in what's called the Ordinary Mind School. And what Joko and Ezra have really, what the main contribution of this school, and particularly of Joko and her lineage to the Dharma and to American Zen, is a kind of emotional realism. It's a Zen practice that allows in all of the parts of ourselves that we actually encounter, including our craziness, our anxiety, our fear, our sexuality, our grasping, whatever, all of those things. And it doesn't get caught up and limited by just attainment of mind states, attainment of insights, or lost in the ghost cave of the absolute, where everything is one, where we're one with everything. Whatever lovely enlightenment feelings arise for us, or whatever fantasies kind of come out of what's driving us in our Dharma practice. And it's a Zen that really directly applies to all of our life. One of the ways that I describe what we do in the Zendo, we use the word Zen practice. And when I was at Zen Mountain Monastery, it took me well over a year to catch on to the real subtle thing that they meant when they were using the word practice. What they meant was practice, turned out. And one of the ways that I describe what we do in the Zendo is we're practicing like in a batting cage. We're practicing the way we would practice our baseball swing. We're practicing here with the circumstances being maximally easy. We're here in a nice, relatively quiet environment with like-minded individuals. We've got nice, lovely, dark-colored cushions to hold us just right. We've got a Buddha, lovely flowers, flame, all of the stuff on the altar to remind us here. We set aside this special time, and we're practicing being with ourselves, and we're practicing that dynamic interplay that comes from getting hypnotized and sucked into the thoughts and grasping and aversion and ignorance of our mind, and the dynamic flow that happens as we open the hand of thought and widen our perspective back out. We're practicing being intimately, open-heartedly, wounded-heartedly, crazy-mindedly present to ourselves, to our lives, just as they are. And we practice in this batting cage, easy environment so that we have skills to draw upon in the much more challenging kind of crucible of the rest of our life. When we don't have the benefits of these cushions and all of these supports and people here encouraging our practice, so that we are able to work to be free amid our suffering elsewhere. And that's one of the key distinctions, and one of the things that I think Zen is does a good job of communicating, is that we aren't ever going to be free from suffering, but we can be free amid suffering. We can be free. The suffering minimally of sickness, old age, death, loss, change is always going to be present. And yet our relationship to that can change as our relationship to our mind changes. And the suffering of all of our grasping, aversion, believing, not going to go away. And so this was, you know, vividly clear for me last week when I had what I think the technical term for it is a total freak out. I had just such, I was so overcome with panic and terror just general spinning of mind stuff. It was on the edge of being incapacitating. Now there's a way in which we'd like to think that practice is going to protect us from that too. You know, this is why we do the five remembrances, to remind us that that we're still subject to sickness, old age, death. But we still get lost in what another one of Joko Beck's Dharma heirs, Barry Magid, calls curative fantasies, like the fantasies of the way in which our zazen or being a Dharma practitioner is going to save us from encountering these in the rest of our life. So this particular freak out was engendered by, of all things, money. I want to read excerpt from Saying Yes on the topic of money. Spiritual practice must include everything, even the temporal worldliness of money. We may imagine that, spiritual practitioners that we are, finances are not worthy of our consideration, yet these issues make an especially rich field for practice. Money issues are rarely about money. Observe your beliefs and behaviors around money. Try to see them with clarity and precision. Then bring awareness to the well of emotion out of which your beliefs and behaviors arise. You may discover that behind most financial insecurity is the terror of losing control or feeling helpless. Honestly facing this fear is the price we pay to be free. Specifically, what was coming up for me last week for reasons I can't precisely account for, but I had decided that there was just no way that I was going to be able to, you know, support myself when I retired, God knows whenever that is. So I was having really major retirement angst. I'm, as you might notice, not particularly close to retirement age. So what was going on for me? Part of this, you know, and so I have in the time since kind of had got to think about a little bit of what this is, and I think it's related to, as some of you may know, my father died by suicide, actually, 7 months ago, leaving a great deal of chaos and death behind. And I think it was, for me, happened to have been related to that. And there's a kind of, that it really activated for me a kind of sense of primal insecurity. Insecurity about kind of the state of my safety in my life. This is a manifestation of the impermanence and the unknowable future that we're always in the midst of. You know, all security is in a way kind of illusory. You never know what piece could change that could leave you without whatever it is that you were counting on, whatever external thing you're deriving security from, or more likely you're deriving a fantasy of security from, a story, an illusion of security. And isn't it interesting, the language there, security? You know, I mean, there's the Securities Exchange Commission, which is all about money. You know, how much we are, even our language itself says money is security. I was having issues of just great fear and terror around this, kind of beyond the ken of all rational stuff. I was really I've seen my mind do these kinds of things, and part of my Dharma practice throughout my life has been, you know, getting to know my crazy mind, getting to know, oh, there's my mind starting to do that thing, and I can bring this to bear in, you know, different ways, but sometimes. In these moments last week, I was just completely overcome by it. And there's another passage from Saying Yes that addresses some of this. Sometimes when our emotions are particularly intense, nothing we've learned from spiritual practice seems relevant. Isn't it when we become lost in our darkest emotions that we disconnect from the heart and judge ourselves most harshly? In these darkest moments, use the breath as a conduit to bring all the sensations of suffering into the center of the chest. In these moments, breathing even the most chaotic emotion directly into the heart is an act of compassion for ourselves. By opening to our personal core of pain, we open to the universal pain of being human. Though we may fear the pain will destroy us, opening to it connects to that which is truly indestructible. Now, there's a lot here. So, you know, working on this book with Ezra really lodged. This is, in my opinion, one of the most helpful Dharma books around, and working on it with Ezra really lodged a lot of it kind of deeply into my mind. And so even as I'm, struggling with this, you know, these are some of the things that come up for me. But I think it's just so liberating to have acknowledged, you know, that sometimes there are times when nothing went from our spiritual practice seems relevant. You know, sometimes we just feel so overwhelmed by whatever form our own craziness takes, whatever kind of patterns and habits of mind, whatever circumstances or whatever, and we just, we feel like whatever we've thought about being a Dharma practitioner, whatever great, lovely calm or insight we may have maybe fleetingly or even regularly attained on the cushion is just completely inaccessible right now. And it's so important. And this is why it's so important to know that the Dharma isn't just about that. It isn't about the calm. It isn't about the insight. It's about the entire thing of your life. So nothing from our spiritual practice seems relevant. In particular, the things that don't seem relevant is this really causes the sharp, at least whatever curative fantasies we've had. You know, whatever fantasies of ourselves as a spiritual practitioner or as a wise and compassionate being or whatever. So we disconnect from the heart and judge ourselves most harshly in these moments. This is an additional level of suffering that we then layer on from ourselves. We're having whatever craziness we're having, and then we're just berating ourselves for being such bad practitioners that we're as crazy as we are and that we're completely lost. Whatever. And so then what Ezra suggests is using the breath as a conduit to bring all the sensations of suffering into the center of the chest. And this is simply a description of embodiedness, of really being physically, viscerally present to ourselves, and taking up the practice of what is this? What is here right now? What is here? What is this going on with me? You know, and there's though we may fear the pain will destroy us, opening to it connects with that which is truly indestructible. And what is that which is truly indestructible? What it isn't is whatever constructed idea of peace and happiness and freedom and enlightenment we have. All of those things are the things that just in those instants of intensity evaporate. But what's the thing that's always indestructible is thusness, is this, this, whatever it is, the thisness of any moment, and the that is beyond the, it's beyond any cognitive, psychological, or emotional content of our mind, beyond any physical state of our body. It's not dependent on any of those. And that's also what we're practicing, connecting to, familiarizing ourselves with in the kind of training ground of the Zendo, with our Zazen. Each time we let a thought be, each time we open the hand of thought and return to this exactly as it is, we're kind of forging a connection and building some familiarity with that. And yet, even when that's... and yet it doesn't make these awful feelings feel not awful. That's the reality of them. It's terrible to feel these things. But feeling terrible is terrible and also not the whole story. And then the other point here is compassion for ourselves. You know, so many of us have trouble with compassion for ourselves, and it's often even those of us who are, you know, might have an idea of ourselves of being compassionate for other people, you know, and when we vow to save all beings, we're in some way kind of vowing to save all beings except one, except this obviously undeserving being. But it's really important to include ourselves in the sphere of our compassionate practice. And, you know, in those kinds of times, to kind of act towards ourselves the way we would act towards someone else suffering the way we're suffering right now, you know? And often we treat ourselves in a way that is so awful that we would never for a moment tolerate it if some third party were treating someone we love dearly in the manner that we're treating ourselves right now. Like if that were taking place in the world and somebody were talking to one of our friends the way we talk to ourselves all the time, we would say, hey, ho, hey, wait a minute, let's, you know, we would so quickly want to intervene and protect and say, hey, there's a lot of anger here, maybe that's not necessary. But when it's us who's the object, well, that's because we deserve it. We are actually awful people. So, what can one do in these circumstances? So, this next section from saying yes is the thing that has been, I think, most helpful to me. Experiencing our emotions fully, without wallowing in them or turning away, allows us to break through the layers of protective armor and connect with the heart. Fully felt, Our emotions can clear the path to the deep well of compassionate love that is the essence of our being. From the wider perspective of the witness, the limited sense of self, coiled tightly around unwanted emotion, begins to expand. We then see this self for what it is, a complex of deeply held beliefs, physical sensations, and distant memories, and we are free to receive the world. So this is a really clear presentation in some ways of what we're talking about when we say in Zen, in Buddhism, there is no self, or the self is empty. What it means is this thing we call the self, the thing that we think we are, if we look really closely, what we see is that it isn't comprised of anything other than deeply held beliefs, beliefs about ourself, beliefs about reality, beliefs about what is acceptable or unacceptable, and its conditioned karmic habits of mind, and it's some emotional content, it's some physical content, and if we look at any moment, you know, we can start to see those individual components, and we can begin to see, and the more specifically we can see a belief as a belief, a physical sensation as a sensation, a cycling thought as a cycling thought, the more specifically we can see that. We can see that we're not that. There's something that's present with us, but we are not limited to that. And this is the practice of what is this? What is here now? And it's a very grounding and liberating practice. And one of the beliefs that was feeding into my suffering kind of during my freak out was also a belief that feeling this right now, and also kind of the state of my life and, you know, financial affairs were somehow unacceptable. There's a denial of, you know, and to say that feeling this is unacceptable, you know, to think that, you know, that there isn't a whole lot of meaning to that, you know. It's not asking our permission to be that way, you know, and whether we accept it or don't accept it, that's the way it is. And it's not, it's isness which is the problem. It's our belief that we can, that it needs our acceptance. One of the other beliefs, you know, kind of going on in my mind was something very specific around expectation of inherited wealth. My father lived very richly, and all of that stuff disintegrated. And there's one small passage in Saying Yes that I thought was kind of trivial, but which has really been unfolding for me in a lot of ways. It says, "Good fortune is arbitrary and certainly nothing we can rely on. Yet we still cling to the belief that it's our right that things go our way." And there's really, I mean, how often are we enacting that belief, you know? And how often are we surprised and outraged or something when things don't go our way? It's really, and yet how often do things not go our way? It's really kind of odd that we cultivate, we carry around such a belief that we think that things should work out for us. And that isn't a truth about the nature of reality. Nothing in our mind is truth about the nature of reality. That's just another belief. And then to see that particular one as a belief, this is me thinking things should come to me. This is me thinking my life should feel secure. This is me thinking that whatever. And to see that kind of belief nakedly, rather than fusing with it and seeing nothing but it, but opening the hands of thought around it, that changes your relationship. And there's a kind of fundamental okayness that you can connect to in those kinds of moments that is that indestructible thing that's beyond the vicissitude of circumstances. It's the fundamental okayness that will be with us on our deathbed, whether we're at home surrounded by loved ones or, you know, beaten and broken in a ditch, it's still there. It's a fundamental okayness that is, you know, accessible even in a hospital bed, in a prison cell. And it has nothing to do with having or not having, attaining or not attaining. Two last quotes. When we can willingly stay with the experience of fear without suppressing in it, wallowing in it, or judging it, our awareness becomes a wider container, the stillness within which the energy of fear, its thoughts and sensation, can move through us and transform. So the first step in all of these things is to willingly stay where we are, to be where we are. When we use up our energy kind of fleeing our inner states, we're on the hamster wheel of samsara. But to kind of turn and go towards it, to really look at it square on, is what allows transformation. And what's interesting here is it can move through us and transform. We don't transform it. It isn't something we do. It's something that that awareness and that energy itself allows to happen. And, you know, I didn't transform it all in one fell swoop. There is no one fell swoop anywhere in Dharma practice, you know. And I wasn't even, you know, and even my ability in those moments to connect to anything other than just pure terror, or anything in addition to pure terror, wasn't even consistent, and you can verify this by just talking to my girlfriend. And yet this for me is the great comfort of Dharma practice. That even in terror, it's there. This is the peerless shield of the Dharma. This is the what is truly indestructible. This is ourselves being undestroyed by these intense emotions. We think that it's going to destroy us, but we are always not destroyed. We're bigger than, more than, inclusive of these things, and thus undestroyed. It's a lifelong practice. The final thing that I wanted to read was this. Facing addiction to worry is more useful than resolving the specific content of our worries. And so, another way of looking at that, facing the addiction of worry, is, believing the content of our thoughts, believing that when worry or fear or terror comes up, that it is, in a meaningful way, about anything. It isn't about. It's just there. And looking at how we engage it with that and our relationship to that is the practice. Maybe we get a one-off of solving some problem or working something out and once again creating a sense of fleeting and illusory security and other curative fantasy, but what about when that disappears? There's not a single state of our mind that we can't bring our Dharma practice to. There isn't a single state of our mind that isn't, as Tori Zenji says, the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments, the very ones that have made us suffer again and again and again. We can work, receive, and even be grateful for everything. Thank you. We'll close with the four.